Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of This Week in Doom. Plenty of doom always to look at, and this week is no exception. Thankfully, joining me to make sense of the doom is the green chicken himself, Doomberg. Hello, mate. How are you?
Grant, I'm doing great. And I was thinking on the way in today that it has been too long since we last recorded one of these.
It has.
But then it occurred to me that that just means we have so much more to talk about.
So much more to talk about. And the reason we haven't recorded one, it's all on me. I've just been buzzing around in my usual hectic way. So it's totally my fault I haven't been able to find time to do one of these. But I'm so glad we found time to do this, because you have been, in my eyes at least, seemingly prolific this last month. But when looking back, it looks like it's actually your normal publishing cadence. It just feels like maybe I'm just a little bit behind because I've been working on so many things that I'm catching up. And there are two and hopefully three of your pieces recently that I'm dying to talk to you about, all of which I've thoroughly enjoyed. And I just find the thought so clear in them. And so I wanted to get a chance to talk to you about. The first one was it titled You Could Be Next or You're Next? I forget the exact title.
Yeah, You're Next. Yeah.
You're Next. I want to kick off with that because I have some personal experience to add to this, which might be helpful. So why don't we kick off with that? Why don't you talk about what that was about and what you had to say, and then we'll kick it and discuss it. Because I think this is really, really important. And as always, the message got lost in people's prejudices about the people around which the piece was constructed. So without letting me steal your thunder, walk us through it and let's kick it around a bit.
Your Next is actually the continuation of several pieces that we've written in different settings with a consistent theme through them, which is that the government's abuse of your ability to bank and transact for political reasons is a clear, present, and I think existential danger to freedom. And we've written about this in the context of the Canadian truckers. We've written about this in the context of Operation Choke Point 2.0, where one would have imagined that our relative sort of skeptical position on crypto would have meant that we would have looked past some of the tactics that are being used in that crackdown. But we wrote in defense of the people in the crypto industry and their right to have banking, or at least to not have it taken away from them without due process. And then, of course, as the world now knows, Nigel Farage, a controversial but charismatic politician in the UK, the leader of the Brexit movement, I think it is uncontroversial to say that he is single-handedly most responsible for Brexit, and he campaigned on it, and more than half the country voted for Brexit. And nobody can therefore say that this politician, Nigel Farage, is a minority or a highly unusual or doesn't reflect the views of some rather large portion of the British people. And he put out a rather disturbing video, 6 minutes long on Twitter, detailing how he had been essentially debanked. His longtime banking partner, which he did not name in the video, which he had been banking with since 1980, which by chicken math is over 40 years, had kicked him out, and he had tried at that time to get banking accounts at 7 different British banks, and all had refused him. And the thing that's most disturbing about this, of course, is not what you think of Nigel Farage's views. It's not what you think of his politics. It's the fact that we've turned, you know, centuries of jurisprudence on its head. Innocent until proven guilty goes all the way back to the Magna Carta. And, you know, having access to banking in modern society is different than it was 50 years ago, when 90% of our transactions were done in cash. There's a war on cash today. When was the last time you made a meaningful purchase using cash? Last time I did was when I was on a vacation in a country that had a very poor financial system, and I had to bring cash because, you know, that society was still mostly cash operated. In the US, I can't remember the last time I spent more than $50 using cash. And if you don't have access to a bank account, you become an unperson. Your ability to exist in our society is prohibited. It's hindered. It's next to impossible. People wonder whether you've done something wrong. The whole point of innocent until proven guilty is to make the authorities prove that you've done something wrong before you can be punished. And, you know, the counter argument is that these banks are somehow private institutions and they have the right to choose with whom they do business. They don't have the right to collude to kick somebody out of the system. And I would say they are hardly private enterprises anymore. They sure don't act like private enterprises when they are insolvent and are in need of public funds for bailouts. They sure don't act as private enterprises when they submit to the wills of regulators in order to avoid their wrath. They are effectively doing the work of the government. We should recognize it as such. And since Nigel Farage has come out, thousands of people have reached out to him and told similar stories, albeit not to the lengths that they've gone to punish Mr. Farage. But small businesses who hold the, quote, wrong political views are seeing their bank accounts closed. This is a real scandal. In our view, it needs to stop. We're a tiny voice in this, but we decided to make Your Next free. It's gotten hundreds of thousands of views and a couple of thousand likes, which is great. A lot of supportive comments. Of course, a few people who are saying that Nigel Farage doesn't deserve banking because he lied to us during Brexit. Well, prove both of those before we decide to punish the guy. And so, yeah, and there's a little story in there about parliamentary privilege, which I think plays a role in this that we could talk about as well. But that's the overview of the piece. And again, this is not a piece we've written in isolation. This is a theme that has been woven into many of our pieces. And when we saw that, we knew we had to write about it.
And I think it's really important that you did write about it. And I shared that piece because I thought it was important. And when sharing it, I very deliberately chose my words and said, look, forget this is Nigel Farage, forget your views on him as a person, as a politician, as a public figure, whatever it is, and just replace him with someone you align with, someone who's of your political persuasion, someone you admire, whatever it is, a public person that you admire. And of course, a lot of people were seemingly incapable of doing that and made this about Farage. And the point goes much, much deeper. And we should absolutely talk about the parliamentary privilege aspect of this, because I think that's very important. But we'll come to that in a second. Subsequent to you writing this piece, obviously the bank was revealed to be Coutts. And, you know, Coutts & Co. has a very prestigious reputation in England. It's the Queen's Bankers, and that's the tagline that they play off, and they have done deliberately for a long, long time, and with very good reason. And it is said to be a hugely prestigious bank and only very important people can have accounts there, et cetera, et cetera. And in the wake of Coutts being outed as the bank in question, we started a whole new news cycle. That the first one was that you have to have £1 million minimum in Coutts or £3 million invested with them in order to have an account. That was the first thing that came out that said, well, this is why Farage had his bank account denied. You know, and I saw that, and look, full disclosure, I have had a Coutts account since the mid-90s, and I can categorically, on the record, assure you and everybody listening that at no point in that time have I ever had anything like that kind of money in the account. Not only that, for I would think the last 20 years, it hasn't had more than a couple of grand in that account. For the vast majority of that, it's a dormant account that I haven't really used. I've kept it open because, you know, to your point about having bank accounts, closing bank accounts is a foolhardy thing to do these days unless you have a really good reason to close it, because opening them again becomes a lot more onerous than it was when I opened that account, whatever, 30-odd years ago. So, you know, that narrative is nonsense. The idea that he'd gone below a limit, I'm not saying it wasn't used as an excuse, but again, it begs the motives as to why that rule applied to him and not me, or the hundreds of people I've seen on social media saying the same thing. I have a Coutts account. I've had a very small amount of money and I've never had this problem before. But it begs another question, Dumi, and that is the fact that it was obviously Coutts that spoke to the BBC to clarify their position and avoid any kind of negative blowback on social media. But in the UK, particularly as a part of Europe, GDPR regulations are meaningful, and the fact that Coutts are discussing someone's bank account with a news outlet, I find truly extraordinary. The fact that the BBC would be tipped off as to, or here's actually the reason why we did it, here's the facts about the matter, are beyond my comprehension. You know, this is a man's bank account. And okay, if he decides to go out and be public with it, he very carefully didn't name the bank. He didn't name any of the banks that he'd approached to try and open another bank account. You know, so what we saw is what we see all the time now. We just saw this war being played out on social media, this war of information and disinformation and distraction and diversion. It's truly extraordinary to me how fast and how far we're sinking as a society. You know, I'm in London right now and trying today, you know, being here in London today and trying to use cash is difficult to do anything, to buy a coffee, to get on the subway, to do anything. It's not easy to use cash. You know, I got a coffee this morning. We are cashless. I went to get some ramen noodles at lunchtime. We are cashless. You know, it's very difficult to use cash. So to your point, restricting access to a bank account for anybody at the same time as you are attempting to make society cashless, I have a real problem with. But that kind of mini soapbox rant out the way, take us back to the parliamentary privilege part of this, because this is, I think, hugely, hugely important.
This is an important thing. And I think, even though I think a form of it exists in the US, this is far more an artifact of British parliamentary history. And it exists in many of the Commonwealth countries as well. And the concept of parliamentary privilege is a good one. And it goes something like this. As long as you are executing your official duties within the confines of Parliament, you can say just about anything and you'll be excused from culpability from the libel laws. And this is actually really important in the UK because, as I'm sure you know, the British have among the most restrictive libel laws in the world. The point of that privilege given to public servants is to insulate them from wealthy and litigious people with business before government. And so if you think a certain business person is undeserving of line item in a budget, you can say what you will about the nature of their business, and you can rest freely knowing that that person is, under British law, unable to sue you for libel. Unfortunately, and we've seen this in various countries, especially the Commonwealth countries, politicians soon figured out that this could be abused to play dirty tricks on people. And all it really takes is to head to Parliament and to say something dastardly about your political opponent with extreme specificity, even to make it sound like it must be true if you're quoting something very specific, and then watch the headlines roll and walk out of Parliament. And in fact, this is so common, unfortunately, that it's almost cliche to have the subject of such false accusations dare the maker of them to say them out, quote, outside of Parliament,
right,
where you can be sued. And in the piece, we tell the story of Chris Bryant, who's a relatively famous member of Parliament, who did exactly this to Nigel Farage. And he went onto the floor of Parliament and said, and I quote, "I'm mystified at why some are still missing from the, quote, imposed sanctions list, including some of the broadcasters. I simply point out that Nigel Farage received £548,573 from Russia Today in 2018 alone. This is from the Russian state." It is pretty clear from the evidence that this was a bold and knowing lie. Nigel Farage received no funds from Russia Today in 2018 because he didn't appear on the network. He denied it loudly at the time. He demanded a retraction. Chris Bryant has not repeated it outside of Parliament, and he refuses to talk about it whatsoever. And we had a picture of him in our piece, and the caption was, you know, profiling courage. So this initial accusation, which now, you know, if you go on Twitter, Nigel Farage is routinely characterized as a, quote, you know, paid Putin puppet, because this is now into the zeitgeist. It's into...
A paid communist stooge slash far-right demagogue.
Yes, exactly. All of the above. And maybe he is all those things. Prove it. And if he is all those things and you could prove it, then we could ponder whether losing banking is a sufficient and fair punishment for those discretions. I would say, based on the evidence, it's very clear that none of that happened. And by the way, if it did, parliamentary privilege would not have been abused to take a long shot at a longtime political enemy. It's just outrageous. And you could see, you know exactly what's going on. By the way, back to your point about leaking to the BBC, which is itself probably the only crime that has occurred in this whole episode. How does that explain the other 9 banks that have since said no to him, and members of his family, and other former members of the European Parliament that happen to be in the Brexit Party? Like, if we're okay with punishing political opponents severely without any recourse whatsoever, then we've lost it. Like, freedom is over. It's only a matter of time before your political opponents grab hold of power and turn those weapons on you. That's why the piece is titled "You're Next." And if you can't fight for Nigel Farage's rights, then you don't deserve yours, period.
Well, this is true, right? It's not about whether you agree with Nigel Farage, and as you pointed out, just under half the population of Britain don't. It's not about that. And the struggle that people seem to have is being able to put aside the personalities in play here and focus on the principles, because these are very, very serious pieces of liberty that are being taken away. And you know, I don't want to get conspiratorial and start waving the freedom and liberty flag around, because it's not that kind of conversation. But this is a very, very real situation. And it wouldn't be so if, on the other hand of all this, as we said at the top of the show, they weren't actively moving to outlaw cash. You know, there will be nowhere for people to go. And you know, we've seen the headlines and people kind of laughing at Chinese credit scores and all the things that are happening in China. And again, there are dots here that people don't seem to be able to join about where this is going. The technology is completely apolitical. It's not a communist thing. It's not a fascist thing. It's not a left thing. It's not a right thing. This is technology that can and will be used by whoever's in power. And as we all know, in most countries, certainly in Western liberal democracies, that pendulum swings from one party to the other over time, depending on the public mood. But for both sides to have access to this kind of way of penalizing people, it sends a shiver down my spine. And it Absolutely. Really does worry me that everybody is getting so caught up in the who and not the what.
Well, I can explain why. Well, let's take a real example, and this is expressed in the most apolitical way possible. I'm going to ask a question and you'll know instinctively what the answer is. And then we'll go into why that's wrong and what should be done about it. Who is more likely to lose a bank account in the United States today? Hunter Biden or Donald Trump Jr.?
Right.
We all know what the answer is, because one party's in power and the other isn't. In my view, neither of them should lose a bank account unless and until somebody proves that they've done something wrong in a court of law.
But hang on, but let's pause there for a second, because is the penalty losing a bank account? Should that be the penalty? I mean, there are all kinds of penalties that you can put on people. There are all kinds of restrictions you can place on a bank account in terms of, right, you're going to have to justify any incoming, outgoing amount over whatever if you're accused of financial crimes. But not having the ability to bank is completely and utterly ridiculous for anybody, whether it's Hunter Biden or Donald Trump Jr. Refusing them a bank account is ridiculous.
And we could decide as a society that for certain crimes, that's okay. Like, that's a stick worth wielding. Like, we have the death penalty. So obviously we have a range of, in some parts of the US, I should say, we have a range of punishments for these types of things. And perhaps losing a bank account is something that certain offenses would justify. Let's, as a society, articulate what those offenses would be, articulate the nature of the evidence needed, i.e., do banks need a preponderance of the evidence, or should they have the same standard as we do in the US for other crimes, i.e. beyond a reasonable doubt, in front of a jury of your peers? So I don't think either of them should lose their bank accounts unless we have, as a society, decided how and when such a punishment is justified. Right now, it's a free-for-all. The banks can wield enormous power at the request of unelected regulators, in many cases, who are doing the bidding of political insiders, or scoring a scalp of retaliation for something happened years ago. This is totally and completely unacceptable. And it is undeniably a political act. The Brexit Party is being sought out and is being attacked for political views. And this is the exact thing that we abhor in totalitarian states, or when we read about the history of the rise of various dictators and their suppression of opposition. This is precisely the type of behavior that we would read about in history books and say, wow, I can't believe that happened and that the people put up with it.
Yeah, and look, let's make no mistake here at what the banks have become over the last 25 years of bailouts and fines for malfeasant behavior. The banks are so at the whim of government now and have been so cowed to effectively become almost arms of the state. There is very little that any of these banks could say no to were the government to say, hey, we suggest you take this action. It's borderline impossible for them to say no to that. So this does become a political situation you know, the banks know that there is so much that they can be beaten with in terms of, you want to talk about sticks, look at all the hundreds of billions of dollars in fines that have been levied at the banks, which obviously are dwarfed by the profits they've made, but that's a conversation for another day. But should a government decide to make it known to the banking community that such and such a person is persona non grata and we want you to withdraw all of their banking abilities, I don't see a bank out there that's going to say, no, that's not right, you can't do that. You know, the further we go down this road, the deeper into Banana Republic territory we get. I never thought I'd see these things. I honestly never thought I would be having conversations like this, and at the same time as having them, be trying to fend off people who think this is about Nigel Farage. I despair at where this is going, Dumi. I really do. And that's why I thought your piece was so important, because as always, you did the very best you could to make it absolutely clear what the target of this is. And it's not Nigel Farage.
It's you. And we wrote about this back in March in a piece called Pandora's Precedent, where we defended the crypto community from the tactics being used. Look, Bitcoin on one side, you'd be hard-pressed to find much in the crypto community, ex-Bitcoin, that you and I would be comfortable participating in.
Right.
Full stop.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that there aren't people in that community doing honest technological development who believe what they're doing is legal. And there's no doubt that word has come down that if you have crypto anywhere near what you're doing, you can expect to be ejected from the U.S. banking system. And precious few people who suffer that have the microphone that Nigel Farage does. And so kudos to him for using it. In that story, we tell the story of a friend of ours who was a successful entrepreneur and a professional poker player, and he had his life destroyed. He was never convicted of anything. He ultimately was forced to plead, obviously, to civil charges because they were going to destroy his family even further. And this was his exit out. Literally, in my view, obviously biased, did nothing wrong. But I could tell you definitively, nothing criminal was ever filed or let alone proven against the guy. And in that piece, which, you know, the opening to the crypto part of this was telling the downfall of poker and how they abused the banks to basically shut down that industry in the U.S., and my friend was courageous enough to give us a quote, but asked that he stay anonymous because he is just now rebuilding his life. Here's the quote. When the U.S. government decides that it wants to put you out of business, the specifics of the law aren't nearly as important as the intent of the prosecutors. The amount of leverage they can bring to bear against you is formidable and vastly outweighs the protections of due process. And ironically, this past December, he lost yet another bank account, even though he hasn't been associated with the poker community for a decade. He's still living with the consequences of this political decision to eradicate the online poker industry in the U.S. at that time, and he got caught up in it, and his life was destroyed. I would argue that the bank that just closed on him ought to have proven what he has done wrong, and he ought to have had a say, at least the ability to defend himself, before a bank that he had been with for many years closes down his bank account. And what do you say to your family and your kids when such things happen to you? It's really amazing. And as you say, I do fear that too many of us say to themselves, I would never find myself in such a situation. Ergo, it's not about me. Ergo, I'm not going to do anything about it. And that's how, unfortunately, how democracies devolve into totalitarian states. And I do fear that we are heading dangerously close to a cliff. And once we fall over it, it's going to be very difficult to come back.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And for all the myriad benefits that technology have kind of bestowed upon us, there is now this technological barrier between you and anyone that you can have a conversation with to try and rectify this. You know, I have a similar example. It's nowhere near your friends. It's an inconvenience at the moment, but my passport has been flagged for some time now. And every time I go through, you know, I cross the UK border and I put my passport in the machine, it says seek assistance, and I have to go. I can't go through the electronic gates. I have to go and see the passport officer, and it happens every single time. It's, you know, it's got the chip in it. It's got the whole thing, and I've asked every time I cross that border. I've asked the border guard, you know, why is this keep happening? Every time they've said nothing. And recently, one guy said to me, "I'm not supposed to say anything, but there's someone with a similar name to you who's on a list." And that's that. You know, the fact that these passports have facial recognition now, they have chips in them, they can see who I am. I'm assuming, seeing as every time I go to the desk, it's a 3-second process once I show my passport. I'm assuming the machines can see exactly what the guard sees, that it's not, but I'm flagged. And I said to the guy, you know, when my passport expires, will this flag be lifted? He's like, no, there's no guarantee that it will be lifted when your passport expires. So for whatever reason, there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can say to anyone. There's no one I can call to have my passport lifted. There's nothing I can do to change it. You know, it's the machine says this is the problem. And so you're thrown into this bureaucracy and there's nothing you can do about it. And as I say, for me, it's just an inconvenience. It just means I end up having a queue for a lot longer than I would do every time I cross the border. So it's no big deal. But it makes you realize when you try and understand why these things are happening to you and why these inconveniences, and obviously not having a bank account is a much bigger inconvenience. When you try and understand the why, you just run into a brick wall very, very, very quickly, as Farage did in terms of trying to get a response to why they were closing his bank account. You know, when he said, he called the bank and asked why, and they said, oh, you'll be getting a letter explaining it. And his version of the story is he got a letter saying your bank account's being closed. That's it. Not explaining it, but just a letter saying the same thing. And there's no recourse. Who do you speak to? If you want to call the bank and say, hey, I need to speak to a human being that can make a decision, listen to the evidence, and actually make a decision on this, those people seemingly don't exist anymore. And they're certainly not accessible to run-of-the-mill citizens who've got a gripe.
It's funny you should say that because, as you know, we opened Your Next with a quote from your good friend, Simon Mikhailovich, to this exact point. You know, if you want to know what it's like to be living in the Soviet Union, when you're standing in the line at the TSA, you're living in the Soviet Union. And he says a lot of bad things can happen to you. You're standing in a line waiting for something, and at the end of that line, a lot of bad things can happen to you. People don't think of it that way, but in reality, though, dot, dot, dot. And that's how we ended the Simon quote that began that piece. I can't imagine how many other Grant Williams are suffering a similar fate. Really?
Well, no, it's hardly suffering, but I make the point just to...
Time is valuable, especially when you get to your age. You know, every second counts.
Yeah, well, that I echo. but you know, look, it's funny. I had a similar thing. I crossed the US-Canadian border a few years ago, and I was going to Vancouver from Seattle, and a friend very kindly lent me their car for the day. I was driving up one afternoon and driving back the next morning just to meet with somebody. So I drive from Seattle. You know, I get up really early. I drive up in the morning. I go cross into Canada. Morning, where are you off to? Vancouver. Oh, have a wonderful day. Everyone's very polite. I come back the next morning, and as I pull up to the US border, there's one lane open in this border. There's a long line of cars queuing, and it must have been 8 a.m. or whatever time it is. And when the clock struck 8, green lights went on all the different booths going into the US. And so the cars fan out like the Blue Angels and drive to their booths. And so I'm the second car in a booth. And the guy, the Immigration Border Patrol agent there, I was the second person that he had to deal with that day. So it's not like he had 8 hours on shift of people being a pain in the ass. And I am always incredibly overly polite and respectful to these guys because I know the amount of trouble they can cause me if they take a dislike to me or they decide that I'm being, you know, rude or whatever. And I couldn't have been more polite with this guy. And I could not have been treated more like some kind of criminal. It was unbelievable, the attitude of this guy. And I finally got through the border and I was so incensed at how I'd been treated for no reason whatsoever other than that he decided that he was going to be that way, that my instinct was, you know, I'm going to pull over here, I'm going to go in, I'm going to complain about this guy. And my complaint would have been, look, I don't deserve to be treated like this. I've done nothing wrong. I was perfectly polite. You know, you can't treat people like that. It's just not fair to treat people like that. And after 2 seconds of thinking about it, I thought, you know what? It's not worth it. It's just not worth Absolutely. It because I know what will happen. My name will get flagged. And every time I cross a border, I'm going to get a hard time. And that's the world we are hurtling towards now, where it's just too risky to call these things out in public because of the flags that get put upon your name in the computers and the blowback that you're going to get for actually making statements like you did in your piece, like we're making in this podcast, about what's right and what's wrong, never mind what's politically expedient, but what's right and what's wrong.
It's funny you should say that because I too have a policy of extreme politeness no matter what, whether I'm pulled over because I ran a stop sign or, you know, yes sir, no sir, and so on. And I've instructed my children the same way. You know, if you ever get pulled over, first thing you do is four-way flashers, roll down all four windows, slap your hand on the steering wheel, And when the officer asks for license and registration, you politely remind the officer that it's in the glove compartment, and would he mind or she mind if you reach over and grab it? And you do everything in your power to signal to that police officer that you are not a threat to their livelihoods, because that's their number one concern when they pull you over. And we've all had bad experiences in the same way that you describe, the random searches and so on. And, you know, some of that is just tactics, and they want to see if they can, like, set you off your center and see how the top spins a little bit. But to your point, we've given far too much power to government authorities. The government used to be the elected representatives of the people. And the government now considers itself the rulers of the people. And they shall decide which rights you are entitled to, which is the exact opposite of how the U.S. Constitution was written. And this is an arc that has bent for decades now, and it's starting to reach the breaking point.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, let's change the subject and let's talk about another excellent piece that you wrote called Tour de Farce, which I thought was, you know, you're back in your energy wheelhouse and back in the thorny subject of climate change. And, you know, again, this is another topic that I just find it amazing how impossible it is for people to engage on these subjects, and how impossible it seems to have any kind of concessionary reasoned debate about things. Okay, look, I understand you feel that way, but what about this? It just doesn't happen. So let's talk about that. Lay out, as you did for your next, lay out the thrust of Tour de Farce, and let's get into that. Because again, I thought it was a beautifully written piece.
Well, it's a great segue, because when we get debanked, it's going to be because of pieces like Tour de Farce, you know, because we're very quickly heading to the point where you cannot write or express any skepticism about climate change whatsoever without YouTube censoring your content, perhaps a phone call to your banker. Do you really want to be providing financial services for somebody who is spreading, quote, misinformation or disinformation?
Well, actually, let me stop you there, Dimi. Let me stop you there and ask you, do you see that as a piece that was skeptical of climate change? Because I read it as not necessarily skeptical, but an attempt to put both sides of a narrative. I genuinely didn't see it as skeptical. I see, okay, look, you're rebutting certain assertions that have been made, say, well, have you thought about this? Have you looked at this? But was it written as a skeptical piece?
See, this is the absolutely most important question you have asked, because it doesn't matter what you and I think. It matters what our overlords think.
Right.
And whether or not it was skeptical of climate change, or eventually insufficiently supportive of climate change.
Yes.
You see? So it doesn't really matter what you and I think of the piece, or how well thought out it is, or how beautifully written it is, or how well researched it is, or how we stitched the story together, or how people who read it enjoyed it and learned something. If our government overlords decide that thou shalt only write extremely positive pieces supporting the climate change narrative, then I'm out of a bank account, per the previous conversation. But with that as an aside, the piece started with the most ridiculous quote that we've ever come across, really. This act of war that happened in Ukraine, where somebody blew up a dam, and that dam flooded communities downstream and ruined agricultural land and killed scores of people. That was an act of war. Somebody did that. It, from all the evidence, it was done on purpose. I don't know who did it. And as we said in the piece, you know, it very quickly dissolved into a team sport argument on Twitter as to whether the Russians or the Ukrainians did it. But that's not the point. The point of that story is, as we like to refer to him, U.S. climate envoy and noted scientist John Kerry was asked about what he thought about this dam's destruction. And his response was just so out of whack to the realities on the ground that it is the inspiration for us having written this piece. And here's the quote: "The war in Ukraine is aggravating the painful effects of climate change." And then he goes on to say, "The war demonstrates how, quote, climate change is a threat multiplier." I mean, how can you spin a climate change narrative on an act of war because a dam was destroyed? Is, as we say in the piece, we're not sure what was more bewildering, that Kerry would think it appropriate to say such a thing, or that the New York Times would feel duty-bound to report it as anything other than parody. You know, it's really remarkable that the war is inconveniently impacting Kerry's climate agenda, and this is his obsession. Every article is proof of climate change, and that we need to do something about, you know, cutting our carbon emissions. And literally, as we said, in the beginning of the war, all the way back last February, the day before Putin crossed the border, Kerry was soberly telling the BBC that he hoped that, quote, President Putin would help us stay on track with respect to what we need to do for the climate. Like, he actually said that. And so the piece was actually about the media and the growing disconnect between what this sort of cadre of elitists and their enablers in the media think is important to everyday citizens and what actually matters to the electorate. And we believe that that chasm between those two things is reaching a breaking point. And in our view, it's no surprise that because of stories like this and obviously, you know, political one-sidedism, that confidence in the media has completely collapsed. And we quoted a new study from Gallup in the Knight Foundation in the piece where, you know, less than a quarter of respondents believe that journalists were acting in the public's best interest anymore, and that only 25% agreed with the statement that news organizations do not intend to mislead, which means, you know, the bulk of people believe that our media comes at the news with a political agenda. And that's unfortunate. And then we go on to say how, like, one of their greatest failures is in the coverage of all things climate change. And every single story must be spun as coming as a result of human-induced climate change. And there is no good news in the climate. There's only bad. And we talk about how the California drought was clearly because of climate change. And now that the drought is gone, that's also because of climate change. And so, as we said in the piece, if everything is climate change, nothing is. And so here we are. And that was the point of the piece. We've since written a follow-up called Wet Blanket, where we dug a little deeper into how the drought has come to a conclusion in California and also in the Colorado River Basin, which is something to be celebrated. And you can guess how it's being portrayed in the media.
Yeah, I thought that was perfectly put. If everything's climate change, nothing is. I just don't read this stuff anymore, because as soon as I see the words climate change in an article, I know what I'm going to get. I know it's going to be a piece that either says, like they said 25 years ago, in 25 years, half the world's going to be underwater, or it's going to be a piece that says climate change is complete nonsense. And no, I'm never going to read anything balanced about it at all. And so for me, this is kind of self-defeating, because the whole aim, I presume, of the media is to impress upon people what a problem this is and a call to action and get people to, you know, take steps to do stuff. And here in the UK, you know, we have this Just Stop Oil movement. And I've never seen a social cause be handled as badly as Just Stop Oil is. I mean, there is a visceral hatred for Just Stop Oil in this country, for the way they've just interrupted traffic and stopped people getting to work and interrupted like the test match in Wimbledon. And now someone came and threw orange confetti at George Osborne's wedding, for God's sake. And you get these movements that are not about, okay, how do we change the climate? It's how do we bring attention to ourselves? And hopefully by bringing attention to ourselves, we bring attention to climate change. You don't need to draw attention to climate change. You cannot open a publication of any kind or pull up a web browser without finding something about climate change. And, you know, when I look at the policies that are being put in place, and you know, we keep coming back to just the abject quality of leaders all around the world. You look at the photo opportunities. You look at yesterday, the Spanish environment minister taking a private jet to a conference, taking a limo and then getting out of the limo and getting on an e-bike to ride the last, you know, half a mile to the conference, making sure that all the photographers saw her. It's pathetic. I mean, it's absolutely pathetic, and it drives me crazy. We cannot seem to have a sensible conversation about the effects of climate change, the imperatives, the ability that the world has to move away from fossil fuels, the compromises that will have to be made. And this is something that you've written about so brilliantly in terms of the quality of life being the amount of energy one is able to consume. And this idea that some guy in a suit who has been elected for 4 years can pull a date out of a calendar and say, we are going to reach, you know, net zero emissions by this date. How? I don't know. But we're going to do it, and we're going to punish people all the way along until we get to probably 6 months before that date, realize it's impossible, and then have to make a load of compromises. No restitution for anyone who's been punished along the way. No thought of the damage it does to people in terms of mandating unaffordable alternatives to them. It drives me utterly insane. And yet if you talk about these things and say, well, you know, hey, maybe this isn't mandatable. Maybe there is a gray area here, and we need to be considerate and try and make allowances for the life that everybody's living today, fully in the knowledge that, yes, if we can cut emissions to zero, what an amazing thing that would be. But the point you've made consistently is you can't make people suffer a lower standard of living today in order to do it. It just, the tail wags the dog every time on this. And I'm just at my wit's end with it, Domi.
So many ways we could go with this. I will say in the piece Tour de Farce, we talked about the backlash, of course. Like if you insist that people live a shrinking standard of living, as we've said many times, on the path from abundance to starvation is riot. The people will take up arms against the government before they will sacrifice the standard of living of themselves and their families. And in Germany, of course, we're beginning to see the beginning of a political backlash. The Alternative for Germany, the AfD party, which has been characterized by the media as, you know, far right and extremist and all of the standard sort of dog whistle terms. I have no idea. All I know is that a local politician, a chap by the name of Robert Sesselmann, became the first AfD candidate to triumph in a county election in Germany. And he got 53% of the votes, which is roughly about the same number of votes that Nigel Farage was able to cobble together for the Brexit referendum, as my memory recalls. And how is the media characterizing this result, which by all accounts came about as a free and fair election? Well, of course, they're characterizing it as, quote, anti-democratic and a threat to democracy. The very act of voting for the, quote, wrong parties is a danger for democracy. And then we showed a Financial Times piece. And by the way, the Financial Times is one of the few remaining decent papers that does good investigative journalism. And even they portray the AfD victory as, quote, merely feeding off of the populace's economic insecurity and existential angst, you know, as though these feelings just immaculately appeared and aren't in response to these policies that are being forced down the throats of everyday citizens. And we close Tour de Farce with a quote that basically says, like, functioning democracies require an effective press corps, one that embraces its basic duty to question government authority. We could not be further from that now. And it's really remarkable. You know, a danger for democracy is an outcome of a democratic election that the media doesn't like. I mean, we've really reached rock bottom. And to your point about the green agenda and net zero, we wrote a piece called Stuck in the Middle with You, where we described how every molecule of fossil fuels saved in the West is going to be greedily consumed in the global South as they try to climb out of their lower standard of living compared to ours and improve themselves. And so really, the only thing that will constrict the carbon emissions of the planet is the production of fossil fuels. Every molecule of oil, natural gas, or coal that is produced will be consumed somewhere by somebody. And even if we eliminate internal combustion engines in the United States and the demand for gasoline falls, the number of barrels of oil that will be refined will be unchanged because people still need the same amount of diesel and jet fuel and asphalt and petrochemicals from the rest of the barrel of oil. And gasoline is a co-product, and co-product economics are funny. And you can even imagine a world where gasoline goes negative, that refiners give it away so they can continue to make the money on the diesel that we all need to power the trucks that move our goods across the country. And if gasoline is negative, you could bet your bottom dollar that every single person in the global South that has a car today is going to drive more. This is the nature of energy. Whatever we produce will be consumed. So the only way to meaningfully reduce our carbon emissions is to restrict the supply of fossil fuel production. Nobody's doing that today outside of Europe. Europe has done that. But the rest of the world, who doesn't care about what the Western Europeans or the coastal elites in the United States think about climate change, are not going to cut back on their coal production, their natural gas production. You think Qatar cares what the British newspapers think about the production of natural gas? And you know, guess who's buying all that natural gas right now today? Europe is, of course. The moment they saw a real threat to their standard of living, they retreated. You know, the global South is more than half of the people on the planet. It's amazing to us to think that because we don't use coal, which is a globally fungible commodity, somebody else won't. Of course they will. Because to the vast majority of people on this planet, access to a reliable supply of coal is a privilege they've never enjoyed. They will burn it. And so, you know, it's just really, as you say, bewildering sometimes to read the news. It does give us an endless supply of things to write about. For example, we wrote a piece about Just Stop Oil because they crossed the line with us when they disrupted the Snooker World Championship.
Yes.
And so,
I mean, come on. There's only so far you can go.
this. Now you've gone too far. They're going to interrupt darts next? I mean,
yeah, good luck. I tell you what, I would not try. I would not try. I would not try that. I would not try interrupting an audience that big with that much alcohol inside them.
Oh, I must say, we'll come back to that in a second. But the piece we wrote was called Youth First. And I believe that, if my memory serves, the social media summary of that piece was deprogramming the green energy con that has absorbed a generation. We've lost a generation of young people. They believe what they're doing is justified. I don't doubt their sincerity. I do question their ignorance. And boy, I will say, just as an aside, I've recently become a bit more fascinated with darts in the UK, and nobody does sports like the British. It's truly remarkable. And I would actually sign up for a pay-per-view to watch what would happen if a Just Stop Oil nut job tried to interfere with a darts world championship. That would be quite
listen, stick around, because the big one is always around the new year. The big world darts championship. And it wouldn't surprise me if they tried it next new year, because it gets a big audience. And listen, if we ever get the chance to go and see that, we have to go and see it, because it is wild.
I will fly out for it, assuming my passport works at the border. But I will tell you, just for those who don't know, these darts championships are played. There's a tiny little dartboard on the front of the stage with big screens, obviously zoomed in on the dartboard so you can see where the darts are going. But it's kind of like a giant bingo hall of tables with nothing but pitchers of beer on them.
Correct.
And the crowd is having a giant party while there's a dart match going on.
Correct.
Is the best way that I could describe it.
About 80% of them are wearing fancy dress costumes.
Yes. And it looks like a truly joyful and remarkable time. And on my bucket list of things to do, including visiting the Crucible, is to go to a darts tournament with Grant Williams in the UK.
All right, we will make both of those happen. We better get to the Crucible quick, because the Qataris are bidding to try and take the World Snooker Championships to the Middle East in a couple of years. So we better do that sooner rather than later. Well, listen, mate, as you said, there's never a shortage of things to write about. And while a lot of them seem to keep coming back to the same principles, I think the things we've talked about today, you know, are two of the real bedrocks here. This climate change narrative, the overarching creep of government into our lives, and the ability that exists for us to be debanked and unpersoned is really, really troubling to me. And the more you write about the stuff, and the more we can talk about it, and look, there will be people, I know, listening to this that will be pissed off at one or both of us for one thing or another. And we have to welcome that, because if we can't set an example, at least have the debate with people that tell us we're talking nonsense and give us a reason why, you can only change this one conversation at a time, you know? So anybody that is listening to this that's angry or takes issue with anything, get in touch. And as long as you're respectful about it, I know I'll engage, and I know you engage all the time with this stuff, do me. It's just so important.
Yeah, you know, I'll close with this, Grant. My children, of course, are, you know, part of the youth and have gone through school and been taught certain things and probably don't necessarily agree today with everything that Doomberg writes. But in 30 years' time, I will be proud to have written the things we've written. And I hope that someday my children will be equally proud to know that their father and his good friend Grant Williams were willing to stand up for the principles that they believe in and risk, frankly, some aspects of their business in order to express it. And so I sleep well, and I'm very privileged to have been able to develop a platform with a great team and obviously with your help. And if we don't use our platform for some good, then what's the point of having one? But I do rest well knowing that in our own small, imperceptibly important way, we tried and we stuck to our principles, even if it wasn't popular.
Well, amen to that, my friend. My goals are a little less lofty. I'm just hoping that my kids one day will forgive me for telling them they had to go to bed before Beauty and the Beast finished. I don't think that's
well,
been
we all
forgotten.
Have goals.
I have grandkids now, and I still don't think that's been forgotten. Yes, exactly. We almost have goals. Well, listen, matey, as always, I love every time we get a chance to have these conversations. It's a shame there's been too long between the last one and this one. We will make sure that the time that elapses between now and the next time we do is much shorter. For anybody listening that isn't already all across everything that you do with Doomberg, just let them know how to find you, because you know your stuff is routinely excellent.
Yeah, the best place to find us is doomberg.substack.com. We are on Twitter, but don't bother wasting your time swimming in that toxic cesspool. Just go over to doomberg.substack.com. You'll find our pieces there. We're also going to be more active on Notes, which is their competitor product to Twitter. We're finding less and less value engaging on Twitter. I'm sure you've experienced the same. And so, you know, we have a a big enough platform, and all we really want to do is write these pieces, and so we're going to keep focusing on doing that. And as always, Grant, great pleasure to see you. Observing, you know, we couldn't live more different lives. I could stay in the chicken coop every day for the rest of my life, and you're just, you know, if you're not on a plane, you're not smiling. And so I don't know how you do it, but you're living your life, and we're living ours, and it's always great to reconnect, because on many important things, we certainly agree, and it's always fun to chat with you.
Amen, my friend. Well, listen, more power to you and the rest of the team, and we'll do this again soon.
You bet.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.